Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Fantasy Focused Football. They tape every Monday through Friday live on Twitter. Be sure to check it out if you're interested in the very best analysis in the game, or if you're just ashamed of how you did in your league last year. You can download or subscribe to Fantasy Focused Football now, as well as the right time wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about college football and one school that apparently just doesn't want y'all to live. We will also send a rest in peace to Bob Gibson and got your stories about the game within the game. But first... All right, so the Miami Heat were out here looking like they was about to get their doors blown off. There was no reason to think that they were not going to get their doors blown off. It looked like it was going to be a swiggity sweep. Now, it is still entirely possible at the time of this recording that it could prove to be a gentleman's sweep. Gabe, you up on the gentleman's sweep?
If I remember correctly, it's exactly what your boy Nick Wright bet on.
Yes, the 5-game sweep. Right, the 5-game. I've actually only seen one series where the gentleman's sweep truly felt like a gentleman's sweep. And that was the 2004 finals when the Pistons beat the Lakers in 5 games. And somehow it felt like they beat them 5 times. Like, I think the Lakers won the first game of that series and it did not feel like they won it. They went to overtime. It was one of those games in LA and it absolutely felt like they lost. Like, it was just called the 5-game sweep up there in Detroit. But Jimmy Butler went out there and had one of them want-to games. All right. Now, I think you guys know something about me when it comes to my NBA is that I am not a person that is resistant to analytics. I'm not resistant to information. You give me information, I'm going to take it. I'm going to do something with it, right? Like, I'm not going to lean entirely on it because I do think that one thing that happens with the dorks very often do not consume basketball from any sort of experiential point of view. You know what I mean? Like, they are able to take these numbers and draw stories from these numbers. But in the end, what works in an aggregated 82-game sample as the regular season goes is not necessarily what's going to work from 7-game series to 7-game series. That's just not what the same game is going to be. So, like, in the regular season, for example, your rotations are probably going to go a little bit longer. Your star players are probably going to play fewer minutes. Once you get to the playoffs, that rotation shortens up. 8 at the deepest is probably going to be your rotation. And you're going to start having guys playing, you know, deep into the 40s in terms of how many minutes they play, for example. It's just a different game. The way it's officiated is a bit different. And a variable that matters more in the postseason than it matters in the regular season is a little something I like to call want to, right? Like, want to. It's a thing. It matters, okay? There's no real quantifying of it. It is not the be-all, end-all, right? Like, I just remember one of my partners stayed with me and my parents over the summer once, and he was real big on the idea of will, right? Which I guess is really effectively no different than want to, right? But will was a big thing to him. But the issue was his determination of who had the greatest will simply came from the outcome, right? Like, to him, whoever won the game was the one with the greatest will. Now, the obvious logical shortcoming there is I could be playing basketball against a 7-year-old, and I assure you that 7-year-old will want to win a lot more, just not big enough to do anything about it. I'm not going to beat a 7-year-old because I got greater will.
Did you see what Mark Spears tweeted out about?
No.
Jimmy Butler said that this wasn't the best game he's ever played.
Yeah, what do we mean, 17?
Yeah, playing against older dudes, right?
Yeah, he got it there. Like, will may have been a significant factor in that one. Just because you won doesn't mean that you wanted it more. But how much you want it does matter. And Jimmy wanted it. Like, Game 3, you look at what that style of play was. I ever tell you the story about this dude named Caveman Gabe? I don't know if I've told this story here. I've told this story in other places, right? Now, I don't know Caveman. Caveman's a dude in Durham named Derek Wiley. He played a little international ball. I think he played his college ball at East Carolina. And the way that I ever became aware of Caveman is one of my homeboys went to high school with Caveman. And he always had all these stories about Caveman. And one of the stories that I always remember as related to him and Caveman was, he said he had a little situation at school with some of the more hardscrabble young lads at his institution. And my man just was honest. He was like, yo, I can't win this. And so he goes to the basketball coach and he's like, look, I just don't know what to do. You know, these guys say they're going to do this, you know, whatever. I really don't know what to do. And the coach's response was, well, have you talked to Cave? And so he went and talked to Cave, man. And suddenly there were no problems, right? This is the Caveman get down. And so I have only myself seen Caveman play basketball one time, and this is at the Summer League in Durham. This is my scouting assessment for watching Caveman play. Caveman was left-handed, and Caveman really only could go left. It wasn't happening, but you could not stop Caveman from going left in one way or another. So there's this dude out there playing in the Summer League, and his name was CJ Leslie. CJ Leslie was a 5-star recruit in high school. He wound up going to North Carolina State. I think he got a little cup of coffee in the NBA, but he turned out to be a professional basketball player. CJ played high school ball with John Wall. Like, he's a year younger than John Wall, but they played high school ball together. All right, so CJ's in this game, and I remember Roy Williams is showing up to see him play. Like, that was the big thing. Like, Roy Williams is sitting on the front row of the bleachers watching the Summer League game, and CJ is killing it. Like, he is out there dominating. And something happened, and he tried to dunk on some people. I don't remember what the dunk was, but I do remember it was pretty emphatic, and he did not make it. And let me tell you who was not very pleased with CJ Leslie for the dunk that he attempted. Caveman. Caveman was on the other team, and Caveman, not here for it. Not here for it at all. And what resulted was one of the most illuminating things that I have ever seen in my life, right? Now, Caveman, definitely older than CJ at this point. He had to be at least 10, 12 years older than him probably at that point, right? But the want to in Caveman went sky high after this dunk that he deemed to be disrespect. All Caveman could do is go left. And he just repeatedly, viciously, and violently went left and straight to the rack over and over. And understand this too. CJ's like 6'8". Caveman's like 6'2". And just took it into his chest over and over and over again and was barking at him too. Just barking at him. To the point where you had to remember, man, CJ's 17, 18 years old, right? At some point, CJ ain't have nothing he could do. All he did was just close his eyes, turn his head away, and try to give him like the wave away with the hand. And I was like, oh man, he got you. Got you. And the only variable that Caveman really had in his arsenal that CJ did not have at that point in his life was want to. He just, like, CJ wanted to show off. Caveman wanted to win, you know? And I'm not saying that the Lakers wanted to show off or anything like that. I'm just saying Jimmy Butler wanted to win. Like, Jimmy Butler was coming for it. He didn't make a single three in that game, I don't think, where he put up that 40-point triple-double shooting 70%. It was all, I'm going to muscle you and get as close to the basket as I can, and I'm going to make these shots. We're not talking about a dude that's been just balling out all postseason offensively, right? Like, it's not like Jimmy's been out here averaging 35 points a game. No, it was simply, I'm going to give it to you over and over and over again. And how you going to stop it? Only way you're going to stop it is if you want it more than me. That's it. I'm not trying to outquick you. I'm not trying to blow you away with all this talent and all these skills. I am here to muscle you. And that's what he did for four quarters. Right there. And I love it. Absolutely, absolutely, 100% love it. And this is why I bring up things as it relates to the dorks, because I feel like this is the sort of thing that very often the dorks are not able to appreciate. That there is a real value, whether Jimmy's a good three-point shooter or not, whatever it is, there's a value in a dude who, even if it's only one every 10 games or something like that, just says, all right, fellas, jump on my back and let's go. Here we are, right? Like, one of the great disagreements me and Pablo had while we were doing High Noon, and I'm not calling him a dork, at least not right now, was his affection for Karl Towns, right? Because I do feel the dorks love Karl Towns more than, like, non-dork basketball people love Karl Towns. And the reason is, if you go look at numbers, Karl Towns looks like the future. Karl Towns 7 feet tall, out here shooting 7 threes a game, making something like 40% of the threes and stuff like that. Like, he'll get to rebounds, all of this. Now, is he a bit of a stat hunter? Absolutely. But you go look at all that stuff on a sheet, and Karl Towns looks like the future. Like, you go look at those stats on a sheet, and you ask somebody who you taking, Karl Towns or Embiid, you're taking Karl Towns just about every time if you're looking at those numbers on a sheet. And then you ask yourself the question, how come your teams are always sorry? Right? Because Pablo's argument was, Karl Towns could be the best player on a championship team. And my response was, how come they can't make the playoffs? You know what I mean? Like, that's just, there's something that's not there. You can't quantify all of this, right? With him, I know the rest of the team's not good, the organization, so forth and so on. I have seen people take sorry teams and sorry organizations to an 8 seed. I'm not saying to get them deep, deep, deep into the playoffs, but Anthony Davis, for example, played on a sorry team and a sorry organization and did manage to get them to got into the second round one time without Cousins being there. You know, like, Karl Towns doesn't have it. There's a certain it that Karl Towns just doesn't possess. Best player on a championship team. Can't be. No matter what his win shares per 48 are. Can't be. It's just not going to happen with a dude like that. And so what the Heat are trying to rock through this whole postseason, and what it's going to take for them to beat the Lakers, is want to. Because something I hadn't thought about as I was watching some of Game 3. You guys know how I feel about the zone, right? I think zone's for cowards, right? I just don't. And I think the dorks who themselves have always wanted to play a little more zone in their own lives because of a general lack of foot speed. You know what I mean? Like, sounds like a lot of y'all went to high schools where the coaches ran a lot of zone. I hate that the people who were supposed to mold you, like turn y'all into men, thought so little of you, to be perfectly honest. They didn't want y'all to learn no real life lessons or nothing like that. You're always going to think you're going to run a con on somebody. You know, you go, you know, there's nothing that a zone can do for you that man-to-man defense can't do for you unless you can't guard your man. I looked up on the floor at one point. The Heat had Kendrick Nunn, Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, and Kelly O'Consonant all out there at one time. And you know what? Yeah, you noticed that, huh? After the O, it's all consonants. You weren't expecting that, was you? I mean, you know, Y goes both ways, but it's all consonants after that. So anyway, Kelly O.C. and those other cats, I looked at that and I was like, yeah, you kind of do have to play zone with those guys, don't you? That's four dudes who can't guard anybody. All right, like Kelly Olynyk is short-armed. He's a big dude, but he's short-armed. Tyler Hero, as fun as it's been to watch him so far, he's a bit comical on the defensive end. Duncan Robinson, game master question. Do you know how tall Duncan Robinson is?
He looks like he's probably about 6'8", 6'7".
Yeah, he's 6'7". People think he's small. Y'all be just minimizing these white dudes. Not you, but you know, he's like a legit 6'7". But he ain't guarding nobody. And Kendrick Nunn, I don't think he was guarding nobody before he caught the cooties. Now he's just trying to come back and get his wind and everything. You know what I mean? I see why that team was out here playing zone. This is the first time in my life I feel like I've watched an NBA team. And I'm like, okay, maybe y'all should be playing zone because I don't know what else y'all supposed to do. Like, when they out here running zone with Bam and Jimmy out there at the same time, I'm like, okay, y'all looking a little weak right now. But with some of these lineups I've seen them throw out there, I'm like, yeah, you got to stick with what these guys know. Like, I feel like Tyler Hero, I feel like his high school was big on playing zone.
With Syracuse, is that not kind of like a hallmark of Syracuse, a bunch of kind of like scrawny white dudes?
Syracuse does the zone in a way that I actually find to be more ridiculous, which is, they're looking for long, quick guys. And then they go play zone, right? Like, people are like, you know, he recruits specifically to the zone. The same guys that you recruit to play the zone should be able to guard people. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, no, they just, you should be able to play man-to-man defense. I'm sorry. There'll never be a point where, unless you have to engage in some variety of guerrilla warfare, there's never no point where I'm going to be okay with you playing a zone. So, like, case in point, when VCU played Kansas in the Elite Eight, the year VCU went to the Final Four, they're like 7 deep and they're playing against Kansas. They're like crazy undersized. Yeah, every now and then to get those guys, you know, a rest, you're going to have to play zone. You know what I mean? Like, I can't call that team cowardly for playing a zone against what was the number one team in the tournament that year. You know what I mean? Like that's not where I'm going. But I look at Brad Stevens, who coached Butler, and they played man-to-man defense. And now you in the goddamn NBA with these dudes out here running a zone. Yo, you outsmarting yourself. I would have understood if he had been there at Butler playing zone. I don't understand you playing zone with the Celtics. Red Auerbach got to be spinning around in his grave right now looking at this disrespect. You disrespecting the uniforms. You disrespecting the parquet floor. You disrespecting the leprechaun. You disrespecting me. Disrespecting your players. Marcus Smart. Like Marcus Smart, you going to tell Marcus Smart we going to play zone. How do you not lose the whole roster right then and there? Like, I feel like Marcus Smart want to stand up right there and hit him with a line from The Wire. Do the chair know that we going to look like some because that's what y'all going to look like. That's what y'all going to look like out here running this zone. It's preposterous. I'll recall Spo out here running no zone when he had Wade, LeBron, and Bosh. Y'all supposed to be the toughest organization in the world. Get out here and guard somebody. Anyway, back to Jimmy and what they did. It was a 1-2 situation. Simple as that. Now, how many games can you dial up in this 1-2? I don't know. But, Dragic didn't play in that game. Bam didn't play in that game. And they were pretty much in control the whole way. Like, that's wild impressive to me. I got no other way to look at that. That is wild impressive to me. Now, let me ask you a question here, Gabe. You are a Lakers fan. I am assuming that you have been watching the games. So who do you think so far has been like the MVP of the NBA Finals?
You know, that's a really good question. I feel like people are going to be putting their money in Anthony Davis just because he's been an absolute monster. But LeBron's been not so quietly like really, really good as well.
He has been very good, but I have definitely felt like in games 1 and 2, if nothing else, that Anthony Davis played like the finals MVP. Do you think that there is a world in which the MVP voters would give it to Anthony Davis over LeBron? Can you see that happening?
I mean, I'm sure some people will, but to your point about it actually like getting awarded, so many people are caught up in the sentimentality of how many MVPs does LeBron have over his whole career, chasing Jordan, all that sort of stuff. We're going to give this title to LeBron. You're going to give the MVP to LeBron. It's just another notch on the accolades of LeBron's career.
Yeah, so I'm thinking of times in my lifetime, so since 1980, where a team's superstar did not win the finals MVP, right? The list is as follows. Cedric Maxwell in 1981. Larry Bird only averaged 15 points a game in that series. Like Larry Bird averaged something like 15 and 15. Cedric Maxwell wound up being the finals MVP on that team. 1985, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I would say he was not like superstar Kareem at that point, but I guess he's still Kareem. So that's a little tricky. James Worthy won, I believe it was 1988. It was either 87 or 88. Had to be 88. 88, James Worthy won, not Magic. Joe Dumars won in 1990, not Isaiah Thomas. Then Jordan, Olajuwon, Jordan, Tim Duncan, Shaq, Chauncey Billups, Tim Duncan, Dwayne Wade, Tony Parker. Tony Parker got one, and Tony Parker was the best player in that series, but he did not. Paul Pierce, then, and you know, that those there was three of them, right? So Paul Pierce, Kobe, and that second one I thought should have gone to Pau Gasol. But they weren't about to do that. Right? And then after that, I think all we got is the Andre, the 2014 Spurs just didn't have a superstar by that point. But the Andre Iguodala year. Like, that's pretty much what we got. The superstars get it. I don't have that many of them where I think it's like, oh, wow, I guess this could have gone either way, right? But the superstars typically get it. But Anthony Davis has been that dude. There's really no way around it. I have watched in this series, not even this series, but this postseason as it is gone, his perimeter game, like, you correct me if I'm wrong, Gabe, but it sure feels like he's shooting better as this goes.
Yeah, it certainly does. I mean, that jump shot has been looking progressively better and better and better throughout the season. Also, too, a thing to think about with AD and his jump shot, at least when he's shooting threes, to your point, AD hasn't been playing too much five, at least it feels like to someone who's watching the games. So AD's out there at the elbow. AD's out there at the elbow extended, where he hit that game winner against the Nuggets, elbow extended.
Yeah, him being a legitimate three-point shooter is a game changer. It is the full realization of what one would have thought was possible from Anthony Davis in his game after the growth spurt, right? Like, it is bringing back what your game was into what your game became and everything else. Like, I think that he has been that dude. Like I told you, I worried after I watched PJ Tucker muscle him around. Ain't been no worry since. Hasn't been there. You know, your boy Kuzma making some shots. You a little displeased with Kuzma? I'm seeing that head shake.
Well, I'm shaking my head because did you see the petition that people started that actually has like thousands of signatures to not give Kuzma a ring if the Lakers win it all?
Why?
I don't know. I mean, I guess like people are just that cold.
It's something to be mad at. Like, I feel like he's playing all right.
Yeah, people are cold, man.
Yeah, y'all are weird, though. Like, Lakers fans, you guys have just evolved into something weird. We talked about this before. You'll be winners again soon, guys. You'll be winners again. But the problem is we're going to have a whole generation of kids who are Lakers fans but grew up as losers. They spent the last 10 years being losers. They have no idea how to be winners, and they're going to need the older Lakers fans to teach them the way. And I hope you guys remember what it's like to be a winner, because y'all been losers so long that I can smell it in your clothes. Damn shame. Okay, we can't pretend like what's going on ain't going on, right? President of the United States got the COVID. Okay. Now, I'm not here to hit you with no political observations here, but this is the encompassing thing I feel like in this country right now. And it would be silly doing the kind of podcast that I do, being who I am, being who you are, being who we are, where we just gonna act like this isn't happening. Like, I don't know about you, but I get up and I go check the internet's just like, so is he all right? You know what I mean? And I think there's something illustrative in everything that happened on Monday, where there was the grand announcement that he would be leaving the hospital, and then he left the hospital, and he comes out, he walks down the steps, he gets in the car, they send him over to the helicopter, helicopter lands on the south lawn of the White House, he gets out, goes inside, he's got the mask on, he gets up to the balcony with the mask on, and he couldn't even wait to get inside before he took that mask off and started breathing heavy. Like, that man is not doing well. There's obvious signs that he is not doing well, regardless of what we're told or anything else. That man is not doing well. And the tragedy of him not doing well is the fact that they got such an investment in saying that this COVID thing isn't a thing, that they've been wild reckless with it. And all these people who have been infected have been in places with their faces all exposed and breathing and coughing and all of these things. Gabe, I don't know if you saw, you seen Rudy Giuliani on TV coughing, hacking it up. You know, like all these, like just about every name of somebody I've heard of that's associated with this seems to have had it. Like, this is a real deal situation, and it's a legitimate crisis. I've been watching on the internet and, you know, the discussion of whether you should pray for Trump or not. Right now, first of all, part of the reason that you have this conflict is because y'all be praying in the first place. Like, I don't have that issue over here. Right. But y'all get into praying, and I'm not of the, no matter who it is, I'm not big in the idea of wishing people well. But let me tell you what I'm also not big into wishing for, like constitutional crises. Like, can you imagine the chaos that would ensue if the president of the United States just died today, a month ahead of the election, in a place where people do not trust institutions and do not trust information and everything else? Like, I don't care how you feel about the dude, this is not the time. You know, like, this doesn't feel like a time that's going to be good for anybody if this happens. But this is where we are. Like, this is the place where we are, where this has happened. And the dude is obviously not doing well, but also telling people that there's nothing to worry about. He up there not able to breathe, and he's telling people that this is nothing to worry about. And so I brought all that up just so you could hear me talk about or give some context to what is going on with LSU right now. Let me pull this link up. I want to make sure everybody understands this, that LSU is all right now. LSU announced that they are changing their game day COVID-19 protocols. They're going to start selling alcohol again and no CDC wellness checks, which LSU spokesperson said was to increase the speed of entry and reduce buildup in lines. What? Maybe you just need to come a little earlier, right? Maybe it's just going to take you a little while longer to get in the game. I could be wrong here, Gabe, but that stadium holds 100-something thousand people. I feel like folks are accustomed to there being long lines to get into the stadium, right? Now, if you want to make the argument that you don't want the lines to be long because you don't want people to be all up on top of each other, got it. Except for the fact that if you keep the line short, they're probably still going to be all up on top of each other. Because we're talking about people who don't really believe that this is a thing. Ross Dellinger of Sports Illustrated wrote a story about how the folks at LSU are still tailgating. About how people went out and got maps of what the property lines were around campus to find out where the closest was that they could get to still set up their tailgates and still do all these things, be as close to business as usual as possible. That's what their game plan was over there. Hey, man, y'all know this thing is still going on, right? Like, you know that this is still an issue. And so I remember when I saw the story in Sports Illustrated, they put it on the cover and they tried to present it as though, like, not being judgmental, just telling you where the people are coming from. And I do think that there's kind of a certain value in the article itself being presented as objectively as possible, right? Just lay it out there and let people draw their own conclusions. I can see that. But if I'm not mistaken, they also put that on the cover. And when they put that on the cover, that was not being presented objectively. That was not, that either that's going to be presented as this is horrific, or look how charming it is. These Louisiana people still acting like Louisiana people. And I feel like they presented it as the latter. And that's bad news, man. Like, wall to wall, top to bottom on all of this, all I'm seeing out here is a whole lot of bad news with this. Why would you say we're going to stop doing checks? Because to me, the CDC wellness checks are honestly like a matter of public service. You know, like, very few people, for good reason, are getting checked out unless they're displaying some symptom that they obviously recognize. That's the only way that they're going in and doing this, is under those circumstances. This is a chance for some people that otherwise might not be up to peep game to find out, like, yo, this might be a problem. And then going and rolling from there. Like, there's a value to it. But that's not what we're doing. They still so damn concerned about what their football Saturdays are. And I just don't see how it's that important. Did you see the students at SMU that had to get kicked out?
I mean, if you look at that end zone in SMU, it looks like a Lambo leap from like 2 years ago.
Yes. Yes. And see, they had to kick him out at SMU, if nothing else, because they have been very public about all the steps they're taking to keep their football team healthy. They are presenting themselves as a model of how to run what is in effect a bubble for a college football program. So you can't have the Athletic come out here and do the story on this and then have these fans up here just looking ridiculous out there acting the way as they were. I just need to know what's so hard about wearing a mask. Like, does y'all's breath stank? Because I ain't going to lie, I put the mask on one time and was like, ooh, boy, I'm going to have to do something about my breath. If I'm going to have to be this intimately acquainted with it, you know, this ain't just about y'all no more. It's about me too. You know, get you some rinse or something, whatever it takes. You go ahead and make that happen. But just put the mask on. Like, this isn't that difficult. It isn't that hard. And I think that there is a real value, like with our reporters, for example, that are in the NBA bubble. Okay. I think there's a value in America seeing those people with masks on doing those interviews. Like, they're standing the requisite distance away and all of that, but they're still wearing the mask. Like, I just think there's something to be said for consistently reminding people that this is still going on. Because what we have, what has stopped since the beginning of this is that when it first happened, the centerpiece of the news stories was how many people were in hospitals, how many people were dying. You know, like that was the hook of the discussions that we had. People are still dying. These rates are still crazy high. That is not the focus of where we are. I think part of it is that this election's in full swing and there really is like a finite amount of news that can be consumed by any individual person. So they've gone to lean more on the election type stuff. But the truth is, this is still in full swing. I follow y'all on Instagram. Your dumbasses are acting like this thing is not still going on. And it is. And so I think that a lot of these programs in college football and otherwise took a lot of steps to get themselves to a place to be able to do this. I mean, I legitimately believe that they do. And I do think that there's a positive message to be sent that if you can work out all these different things and work hard in the process to do it, then we can come back. You know, that we can get back to doing what we want. Like, I think there's something to be said for demonstrating to people and showing them, hey, this is the level of discipline that we have exhibited. This is the level of discipline that we have demonstrated. These are the things that we have done. And now, as a result, we can come back and do this. I think there's something to that. So we got to demonstrate that level of discipline. We got to show what all this is, right? We have to make it clear that until everything is on the up and up and until everything is right, we can't get back out here kicking it like we used to, you know? And more, I just feel like we're looking up and people just got tired. Like when the LSU story came out, I retweeted it and was like, we give up. Because that's what I think it is for them. It's just a matter of giving up. They just don't feel like doing this anymore. People don't feel like being inconvenienced anymore. And look, let me tell you, I'm out here, you know, walking around in New York, seeing these streets, man. There's some people that can't go back inside because their money all messed up. You know, like I know that not everybody that's out here is there voluntarily. I get that. You know, and I know there's a lot of circumstances that's around us, but we have to legitimately do the best that we can. And so that's why it's so disappointing to me when I look up and I see LSU and I'm like, yo, so y'all just aren't going to try anymore? You're just going to give up on trying? And it becomes further complicated when you talk about LSU, because keep in mind, LSU has a state with a, it is a Republican state, but I think they got a Democratic governor. I think that's the math on it in Louisiana right now. But the Republican Party believes that it is in its best interest to demonstrate to people that this ain't that big a deal. Like, there's no way around that. This is not a political statement. They are a group of people who happen to be a political party who are carrying on as such. President of the United States, for example, trying to tell people not to be afraid. Bro, I'm scared to death, and I'm going to keep on being scared to death, and I ain't going to stop because you said so, right? There are real things that are going on here. And so you've got to wonder, at these college football games, you talk about you don't want politics in your sports. You think them getting rid of the CDC wellness checks, you think that ain't politics in your sports? And that's just not just politics in some way that you might find annoying. That's politics in a way that might legitimately affect your life. You're okay with that politics in your sports? Come on, dog. That ain't it. So I'm just telling you, do better than LSU. Like, I just believe that there's a diligence that we have to continue to carry on with. And I realize that the likelihood is that most people who are listening to this are inclined to agree with me and my take on this thing. But I also understand that some of you who agree with me are also getting a little wobbly, wavering a little bit, getting a little bit weak on it. I understand we've been doing this for like 7-8 months. You know what I mean? Like, I get why this could be very difficult for you to keep on going. I'm just telling you, we have to keep going. We have got to keep going, because otherwise, when we stop, it's going to be a bad stop. It's going to be the kind of stop that you do not want. But like, watch what's going on with the folks in the White House, man. People are going to keep turning up positive, and you're going to start hearing the back channel stuff about how some of them are physically struggling. This thing is real as steel, and it's still getting people. It's still snatching them up. And I would like for you to be here to continue to listen to this podcast. And damn it, I'm going to keep on doing it, because I ain't giving up. And I hope like hell you ain't either. All right, Bob Gibson died over the weekend. Now, one interesting kind of like generational age divide that we have is, what does it mean to you when an old baseball player dies? Like, Gabe, do you have much of a concept of Bob Gibson?
My concept of him is just knowing that he's like a legend of the game and like the type of pitcher he was, but not necessarily like him amongst his peers at that time and what it meant, you know?
Got it. Got it. And so I mentioned that just because I was born in 1980. And so like America's pastime, all that stuff or whatever, right? It's really like the 50s and 60s that are bringing that around, like as a concept. And so as I'm a child, the heroes of the earlier generation is Willie Mays. You know what I mean? It's Ted Williams. It's all these guys. Like the great baseball players of the 40s, 50s, and 60s were revered in a way that honestly, I feel like the great players in none of the other sports have truly reached. Like not even like the best football players, whatever it is. Like it's just something different. Like when Willie Mays dies, you're going to understand it. Like you're going to see where it comes from for a whole lot of people. And not just people who are of that age, but people the next generation down, because we were raised with the idea of what a Willie Mays was, a Hank Aaron was, a Bob Gibson was, in the way that people your age, as you're like 12 years younger than me, people your age are less likely to have grown up with those guys in that same way. And like the great baseball players of my youth, we have not carried them over in the same way that we did with those people. But Bob Gibson is a shining, singular, legendary figure, right? Did you know Bob Gibson used to play for the Harlem Globetrotters? Yes, Bob Gibson was a bad man. Let me give you another story about Bob Gibson. This is actually a story from 2002. And the story is titled, Police Cite Gibson and Other Driver with Assault. Baseball Hall of Fame pitcher Bob Gibson was cited for assault after a case of possible road rage. Authorities said the situation started Friday in traffic in Omaha and ended about 10 miles away after a fistfight at an Interstate 80 gas station in Sarpy County. Miguel Sanchez allegedly pulled out from a car lot and cut him off in traffic. Sanchez admitted he retaliated and cut Gibson off, but believed the altercation would end there. I learned a lesson, Sanchez said. Both Gibson and Sanchez were cited Saturday for third-degree assault. Quote, I don't have any comment, Gibson said from his Bellevue home. It just doesn't do any good to talk about that kind of stuff. Sanchez claimed Gibson followed him for more than 10 miles as he left Omaha and traveled west on Interstate 80. When Sanchez stopped for gas, he said Gibson confronted him. I turned my back to reach for the nozzle. That is when he hit me here and hit me here, Sanchez said, pointing to both eyes. He also had a cut above one black and blue eye that he said required 5 stitches. Gibson told authorities he followed Sanchez because he wanted the Omaha man to pay for his eyeglasses, which he said were broken when Sanchez cut him off in traffic. According to police records, Gibson also claimed the 45-year-old Sanchez swung first. Sanchez said they continued to fight until it was broken up by another driver. According to authorities, Gibson left the scene after the fight and a witness wrote down his license plate number. Okay. Ask me how old Bob Gibson was when this happened.
How old was he, though?
66 years old. Bob Gibson was the meanest son to play baseball that I think I have ever heard of. Like, and not like the Ty Cobb mean, where Ty Cobb was out here sharpening up his cleats and spiking people and stuff like that. No, Bob Gibson's whole reputation is just being mean. Throwing really hard, scaring the hell out of people, being mean. Where I think Dusty Baker said that Hank Aaron's advice to him about Bob Gibson was, don't look at him. And when he throws at you, don't charge the mound because he'll kick your ass. Nobody wanted it with Bob Gibson. Tim McCarver tells a story about the first time that he went to talk to Bob Gibson, like, you know, at the mound, like, you know, as the catcher go out there. And he said that Bob Gibson told him, go away. The only thing you know about pitching is that it's hard to hit. And sent him back. And here's what I want to know. How much of a man does your black ass have to be in the 1960s out here throwing at and fighting and talking crazy to all these white folks and they love you for it after the fact? That's what I need to know about Bob Gibson. Like the way that we talk about Bob Gibson is like he's like a basketball enforcer, basically. Like all of this stuff, he's out here sassing white folks, scaring white folks, daring them to fight them. And they like, nah, man, you got that, Mr. Gibson. You good. You dude, playing in St. Louis. It ain't like they love us in St. Louis. Maybe they love the ones that play for the Cardinals. I don't know. But it ain't like they love us round those parts. And Bob Gibson got to be Bob Gibson. Like, somehow I feel like we have actually underrated the magnitude of this man, given. Like, I just don't think you, like, we just think about how mean Bob Gibson was and how surly and everything else. But all of that in the context of his time. Like, he was not out there doing any variety of skinning and grinning or trying to smile and make people feel. No. It wasn't none of that. He was surly as hell, and people loved him for the fact that he was surly and respected it. Maybe that's what happens when you have a whole season with a 1.12 ERA. And the best part about that, I think you've seen this stat presented, he was never replaced for another pitcher that season. He was pinch hit for like 7 times, but never was it, we're taking Bob out and we're putting another pitcher straight in. And you know why? Because you go tell Bob Gibson he's coming out to catch in the season where he's got a 1.12 ERA. You go tell Bob Gibson, hey, man, I think we need to get this lefty-lefty match. You go do that.
I feel like we need a Bob Gibson documentary.
I also do. And, you know, because the black, just generally, though, like him, Bill White, I feel like I'm missing a couple of guys, but the black dudes that played, Lou Brock, like the black dudes who played for the Cardinals at that time, they seem to be beloved by Cardinals fans, but I'd love to know how that went because they were living in St. Louis, which has a wild racist reputation. Such a racist reputation that the NBA is like, nah, we ain't putting no team there. It'll never work.
When you describe him as like a basketball enforcer, it's kind of like those NFL films when it's like Deacon Jones.
Yes.
Way, way, way back in the day. Just badass dudes.
Yes. You got to be that dude for everybody to be like, yo, he's so great and he's so mean. They don't say that about us at our offices. I'm going to tell you that now.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from tech.
I'm Heather Kelly, a Washington Post tech reporter in San Francisco. The biggest tech companies have spent years building elaborate billion-dollar headquarters to their top employees. They're the kinds of offices that people actually want to sit in traffic to get to. Spacious, green, filled with perks like gyms, free food, even on-site dry cleaning. In Silicon Valley, Apple's new home looks like a giant spaceship. Facebook's latest buildings have lush parks on top and splatter art inside. In Seattle, Amazon has built massive round greenhouses at the base of its main tower. And there are even more elaborate plans still in the pipeline, like Google's sprawling mix of housing and offices in San Jose. But what happens to these headquarters when the only perk employees want is to work from their homes, eating peanut butter out of the jar and wearing soft pants on the sofa? Or when tech workers realize they could do their same high-paid job from locations with drastically more affordable housing? While their offices sit mostly empty, the tech industry is deciding what to do next. Some, like Twitter, have already decided to allow employees to work remotely indefinitely. Others, like Facebook, are planning to allow some of their workforce to be remote, but not all. And experts say that some jobs will likely always be based at these central locations, like teams working on secretive new products and innovations, and high-paid tech executives. While it's still too early to know exactly what Silicon Valley, Seattle, and New York tech scenes could look like after the pandemic, there are a few options. Companies could strike a deal with their employees and let them work home for part of the week. That could make the long commute easier to handle, and people could move further away from cities into the suburbs. Or the ability to work remote could become a bargaining chip for the most sought-after talent and lead to certain kinds of jobs being done from a distance. If a gifted programmer wants to work from Hawaii, competing companies will probably let her work from Hawaii. Or companies could split the difference and invest in more secondary offices in cities like Phoenix, Denver, Salt Lake City, or Austin. Whatever happens, tech workers will probably still have good jobs, and their companies will continue to make money. The biggest change could be for the cities where they're located. They've seen their housing costs skyrocket, but also come to depend on the company's tax revenue for social services. Their future is far from certain.
Yeah, that last part was the part that I was thinking of, which is, like, what's going to happen to the housing game in all of these places? Well, folks just don't need this bread to live where they are. I mean, they don't need to, if they don't need to live in these locations where it costs so much money to be there, then what?
It might have even actually been a previous story of Heather's that I read where there was a discussion around whether or not if you're working remote, if your salary is going to be adjusted based on the cost of living of where you're at.
Yeah, well, it has to be.
The idea of like getting rich off your Facebook salary and living in like Bozeman, Montana in this, you know, huge estate.
Yes and no. you're not going to have the same salary that you had living in the Bay, but your salary is probably still going to be pretty good relative to wherever your location happens to be. And so you'll still be in a place where you are able to stack. But no, they can't. So like, if you were in the Bay, right, wherever your job happens to be, and then you move to the Houston office, they can't let you keep your same salary because now all of a sudden everybody in the Houston office got to make what you make that does your job. You see what I'm saying? Like, it throws the whole salary structure out of whack. And so that's not going to happen. That's not like that con, like people think they're going to run that one. That's probably not going to be it. Like, some people kind of pull it off, and maybe the reduction still takes you to a place where it's superior to, you know, what a lot of people get that are working in your new location. But come on, man, they thought of that. Like, you think they stupid? All right, cool. Well, you know, they are paying you all that money in the Bay because that's what it takes for them to get you to do it, because otherwise you can't live anywhere. But all that stuff they've done in those facilities, that's right. They tried to make it to where you never wanted to leave work, and you just wanted to be there forever and ever and ever. And people don't even want to set foot in that place. Matter of fact, play the whole music.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
Yeah, they thought they was in this place, but they're like, cool, we'll make you stay here forever. And people are like, I'm not putting a toe in that place. And I do think that there's a value to people going to offices. Like, I do think that there's a value in people being around each other, you know, and kind of the interpersonal connections. Like, I mean, I this whole max headroom life, like, I don't think that's necessarily the way things should be. But it ain't gonna be that no time soon.
Some of the tech campuses have also kind of like been the leaders in terms of setting when you'll go back to the office.
Right.
At first with Twitter, it was like, oh, next summer, next June or whatever. And now, like Heather was saying, it can be indefinite for people. I mean, I just saw the other day that, you know, the movie Dune that was supposed to come out later this year, they just rescheduled that to, you know, when it was supposed to come out Christmas this year. Guess when they rescheduled it for?
Next Christmas?
Next October.
Wow.
October 2021, a year from now.
Yo, I am so glad that I am not the CEO of Regal Cinemas or AMC Theaters. Or any, like, can you imagine what it's like for them every time they got to go talk to the shareholders? Just imagine. So how are we going to get people back in the movie theater? I don't know. That's a great... They ain't no takeout dining at the Regal Cinema. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what they need to start being like. It's like, yo, we're going to start selling this popcorn outside for $7. Nope, not going to work. Not going to happen.
Oh, my gosh. All right, this next story comes from crime.
My name is Brian Rokos. I'm a crime and public safety reporter for the Press Enterprise newspaper and the Southern California News Group in Riverside, California. Lorenzo Marujo has had a difficult life, spending the better part of 30 years homeless. But Marujo learned what turned out to be a valuable skill along the way. Martial arts, specifically jiu-jitsu. It helped protect her while out on the streets. Now 67 and living in an apartment in Fontana, California, Marujo calls herself the Lady Ninja and a master assassin. And on September 28th, those skills and Marujo's fearlessness helped save her neighbor. Fontana police say 59-year-old Donald Prestonwood entered Marujo's apartment under the influence and calling out for his girlfriend. Marujo chased him off while wielding a baseball bat. He then ran down to the apartment of 87-year-old Elizabeth McCray, the mother of Prestonwood's girlfriend. Marujo followed, went inside the darkened apartment, and heard McCray scream. Marujo, who was just 4'10" and 100 pounds, slew-footed Prestonwood, who was 5'10" and 170, to trip him, and then she used her favorite martial arts technique, bending back someone's fingers to pry him away from a fallen McCray. Marujo said he screamed in pain, and then she held him down until police came. Fontana police officer Jenny Vinzer called Marujo's heroics a feel-good story. But for Prestonwood, it was a feel-bad story.
Hey, man, that is the most exciting. I didn't know you could get exciting news out of Fontana like that. I've been out there before. I know that's the Inland Empire. used to live out there in them parts. San Bernardino County. I know something about that. And let me tell you, when I rode out to Fontana, I did not think that that was the kind of place where you had exciting stories about people taking on burglars. And maybe this tells you everything you need to know about Fontana, that the burglars don't even really go that hard. The old lady's got something for the burglars. It reminds me of this story many, many years ago. It's like 30 years ago. Gabe, are you familiar with the club? All right, so there was this device called the club that they used to sell in infomercials. And what you did was, club had a couple handles or whatever, and it was adjustable in the middle. And you would take it and you would extend it out and lock it. And it would make it so that somebody could not steer the wheel. So if somebody stole your car, they couldn't get out of there. And something happened, and some dude tried to carjack this old lady. I believe she was in Detroit. And apparently she gave him the hurt with that club. Like, he tried to come with it. She sprung into action and started swinging the club. And my daddy loves telling that story because they said something. They asked the woman about what she thought his sentence should be or his punishment should be. And her response was, if he survives, I was trying to kill him. She wanted to come up to him and be like, you hadn't thought of that, had you? Right? Like she wanted to hit him with that. But she swung that club on him. She said, I was trying to kill him. So, yeah, I say that, man. People, this all, I'm just going to break into your house. There is a wide range of outcomes that can result from the bust in the house program. Again, you have to remember, I'm from Texas. I just assume that everybody's got heat. Everybody at all.
When you start assuming, that's a step too far.
Yep. Assume they're packing heat. Like, if you start with that presumption, you'd be amazed how your behavior changes.
In every walk of life.
Everywhere you go, they hold.
All right, this last story comes from travel.
Hi, I'm Shannon McMahon, and I'm a reporter for the Washington Post's travel section. I recently covered an effort in Singapore to bring cruising back to the city-state by way of these cruises to nowhere, which would be the first cruises to operate there since March when the port shut down and cruising at large stopped. Cruising to nowhere means sailing from and returning to the same port, which would essentially be sort of a pleasure cruise for people who miss cruising and want to get back to sea on these massive cruise ships. But of course, there would be these new health protocol in place. The Singapore Tourism Board told me that they've partnered with a maritime safety firm that's developing new health standards to let those cruises to nowhere start operating. Daily Singapore newspaper called The Straits Times first reported this, and they say that the program is aiming to sail at half capacity to start for about 3 months. This move to cruising to nowhere actually follows these really popular flights to nowhere that you might have heard of. I've also written about those, and those are these plane experiences, or in some cases actual flights, that people can book in places like Taiwan and Japan to get a taste of flying again. Qantas recently offered some in Australia, and those sold out really quickly for travelers who are like dying to get back on planes. Singapore Air is doing those as actually grounded, quote unquote, in-flight dining experiences. This Taiwanese carrier, EVA Air, has been actually flying Hello Kitty flights to nowhere in these beloved Hello Kitty-themed jets that they usually offer service on. But as for the cruises to nowhere, those voyages don't really have a set timeline to begin again. But the Singapore Tourism Board says that it's working closely with cruise lines on safety measures, and some cruise lines that operate in Singapore, Norwegian, Celebrity, Princess Cruises, those all have voluntarily stopped sailing through at least the end of October. So TBD when those could begin operating.
So, Gabe, so I understand this. You get on the ship and the ship just come back?
Does a little loop in the harbor or wherever it goes.
I don't feel like this corrects what the problem is about being on a cruise.
No, it doesn't. The whole point of stopping cruises was to prevent people from congregating in close spaces, right?
Yeah, and to get stuck on the boat, right? It was not like the problem with the cruise ships were not the destinations. It was the boats. And I'm sorry, if you out here getting on a boat, that's your... I would not recommend it. How about that?
The only variable that's getting removed is the destination possibly not letting them port there.
Yes.
That's the only thing that's getting removed. We don't know anything about like if they're allowing like less people on the boats or if they're like instituting any sort of like social distancing measures, but you're putting everybody on a boat.
Man, but the cruise people, all they did after they couldn't sell for now, they just started selling for later. people were snatching them up. Like, I don't know. And I can only imagine what it's like now.
Are people so desperate to be inconvenienced with travel? You know, when you go on the plane and go on the cruise, when Shannon was talking about how people are down to do like dine on a plane while it's like grounded.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything like less convenient or like less comfortable than dining on an airplane?
Right. No, I think people are just antsy. Like, I'm doing my best not to be judgmental about it because the things that people are doing are so stupid, right? And I'm seeing it being done by people who themselves are not stupid. You know, like, I had a buddy of mine who took a trip to Mexico and he talked about all the steps and everything. Like, he checked it out, you know, and everything, and it wound up being okay. Like, for me, it just ain't worth it as it stands. It's just not. I don't want it. But I look at just some of the individual things that people are doing. And I'm just like, yo, man, this is just dumb. And they're not dumb people. Like, I just think it's just getting to people, you know? And so I don't want to be too harsh about the things that they are doing, but I can't pretend like the things I see aren't stupid.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the Right Time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. So just the week after, you introduced me at least to the game within a game. We had a game within a game situation this past weekend, did we not?
Oh, yeah, man. The game within the game, but as the game, sometimes there's an interpersonal situation between the cast that's on the field that is the game within the game. And we were talking about that at the NBA Finals because Tyler Hero and Kyle Kuzma have a woman that they have both dated. And, you know, she is there because I told y'all that was going to happen. Remember, I told you. But anyway, we got a whole new level of it with this week. It was Golden Tate and Jalen Ramsey, because Jalen Ramsey was with Golden Tate's sister, had a couple kids with her. I think he left her while she was pregnant. Golden Tate did not take that very well. And Jalen Ramsey hit him with a buyout form tackle in that game. And then after the game, they got to swinging on the field. Jalen Ramsey was on the cell phone like 20 minutes after the game trying to call people. He was waiting outside the locker room, wanting to come holler at Golden Tate. And, I mean, it was a lot. I generally believe that people need to mind their own business, but I'll watch them fight.
The game within the game.
That's right.
Thought it would be interesting to reach out to the listeners of the show and see if they would share game within a game experiences that they have had or they have witnessed. We had a couple of good ones. Our first one comes from B in St. Louis.
Bo, what's up, man? Back about 20 years ago when I was a senior in high school, we had this cat on our team, right? And his dad was a former prominent St. Louis athlete. And his dad and his mom had just gone through a divorce. And we were playing a rival, and there had been rumors for a few weeks that his mom, who was still quite a good-looking gal, had actually been sleeping with one of the kids on the other team, hooking up with him. And I don't ever know if the rumor was true or not, but the coaches definitely knew about it and kept this our dude off the field so they didn't get into any fights. Well, after the game, we head up to Steak and Shake. A bunch of baseball bats involved, some windows broken, a bunch of cops involved, and five or six kids ended up in jail that night. But we still, that legend has gone around with my boys today. We don't know if they ever hooked up, but that was definitely the game within the game.
He said that somebody's mama was on the dude on the other team?
With a player on the other team.
Wow. And she probably thought that she was doing something like, assuming this is true, if she got caught, she would be like, well, at least he wasn't on the same team. You know, that would be against the rules. I got news for you, right or wrong. Once that story goes around, whether or not it's true, nah, maybe I run these laps. Maybe I don't. Have it your way.
Unbelievable. All right, this next one comes from Aaron and CT.
Hey, Bo, what's going on? This happened to me and this cat that I grew up playing baseball with. When we were 13, we played on separate teams. But because we were two of the better 13-year-old players in the town, we sometimes play up with the 14 and 15-year-olds. So it was on like a Tuesday. We're playing up with the 14 and 15-year-olds, and we're on the same team. I accidentally stepped on a bag with my cleats, and it was his bag, and it cracked his phone. So it was 100% an accident, and I 100% owned up to it in the moment. So fast forward to later that week, and we're playing back on our respective 13-year-old squads. It's a Saturday morning at like 8 a.m. I've never been a morning person. He's on the mound. I'm batting third. I step up to the plate. And the first pitch I see is like his best fastball square in my left eye. I threw the bat and I just stared at it. like menacingly, like I'm Samuel L. Jackson, just stared at him. And I took a step towards the mound, and umpires and the catcher and everybody kind of got in between us, ushering me off in the first base. So after the game, I rolled up on him, shoved him from behind. I said, dude, what the hell was that? And he looked at me and he said, come on, man. You know that was on my phone. I don't know, man. It's just a game within the game. Appreciate the call.
I can't imagine. Like, yo, what you do that for? Why? You know what the problem, at least he said what the problem was when he said, you know what it was. Because normally just be like, you know what it is. Nah, I don't. You know. But for real, I don't. Well, you should.
Seeking retribution on the diamond rather than seeking retribution in the sense of like, yo, I'm going to beat you up until you give me my money so I can replace my phone.
It's a good point. Like, you could have just asked for the money.
So second story with baseball, something going on with baseball we haven't seen before. All right, so this last story, a story that the guy didn't witness himself, but it's actually a historical game within a game story. This is from Terrell in New Orleans.
What's up, Bo? Hey, man, about your topic, man, you got to bring up that time. 1994, Deion leads San Francisco back to Atlanta. Deion was covering Andre Bad Moon Rising. We know that was more than just a game. Because Andre Rising was first pissed off that Deion left him. Secondly, he wanted to show that he could do it without Deion. And we both know what happened. Deion spanked him in a fight. Deion covered him to where he couldn't make a catch. And Deion made sure he ran an interception back in Atlanta. And like he said, this is my house.
Yeah, so I have to say, I didn't think anybody really won that fight. Like, I felt like that was a fight between two dudes who hadn't really done no whole lot of fighting. I did not feel like that fight had a clear victor, per se. However, Deion did just come house the place. Like, when he took that pass down the sideline, I was just like, wow, this is going to be the slowest that Deion has ever run in his life, because he is going to walk, if he can, into the end zone and enjoying this. My only thing is, stunting on the Falcons for what? You know, here's what I would ask Deion if he decided that he was going to stunt on the Falcons. Let me look this up right now. Because I looked this up before, and this is the craziest thing about Deion Sanders. Deion Sanders, as great as he was as a corner, he didn't, like, actually make the defenses any better. So his rookie year, yards per passing attempt allowed, the Falcons were 27th. All right, let's go to 1990, Deion's second year, 26th. Let's go to 1991, Deion's third year. Oh, 23rd, way to not just be abject. 1992, 28th. 1993, 28th. And then 1994, after Deion has left, 26th. With Deion, without Deion, same damn thing. So glad I don't do that no more. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Also, thanks Christina Buswell. Also, thanks to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Heather Kelly of The Washington Post. Check out her story about what's going to happen to all these fancy tech headquarters now that people are working at home. Thanks to Brian Rokos of The Press Enterprise. Check out his story on the Ninja Lady, 67 years old and has some drama for an intruder. And thanks to Shannon McMahon of The Washington Post. Check out her story on cruises that sail to nowhere. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.